a series of dreams when nothing comes up to the top. Everything stays down where it's wounded and comes to a permanent stop. Wasn't thinking of anything specific, like in a dream where someone wakes up and screams. Nothing too very scientific, just thinking of a series of dreams. Thinking of a series of dreams. What the time and the tempo drag, and there's no exit in any direction except the one that you can't see with your eyes. Was it making any great connection? Was it falling for any intricate scheme? Nothing that would pass inspection as you're thinking of a series of dreams. Dreams where the umbrella is open. The path you are through, and the cards are no good that you're holding, unless they're from another world. In one, the surface was frozen. In another, I witnessed a crime. In one, I was running, and in another, all I seemed to be doing was climb. Wasn't looking for any special assistance. Not going through any great extreme. I'd already gone the distance, just thinking of a series of dreams. Dreams where the umbrella is folded. The path you are through, and the cards are no good that you're holding, unless they're from another world. Just thinking of a series of dreams.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstud Show, the radio show where we talk about comics. Goodbye, Bob. He's fading out. You know what's funny? 2 weeks in a row, I've played Bob Dylan.
Wow.
Yeah. This week's guest is Rick Veitch. And let's see. I guess I got to do the prerequisite. CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver at UBC. It's a cold, rainy day here in Vancouver. It's about six past two. Or I guess if you're on the East Coast like our guest, 6 past 5. So how are you doing today, Rick?
I'm doing real good. How are you doing, Robin?
Good. So we got you there. Rick's latest book out of many, you have a library of stuff out at this point. Army at Love, as well as You Can't Get No, or Can't Get No, I didn't say you, it's just Can't Get No. And the self-published collections from King Hell, let's see, Abraxas and the Earthman, Shiny Beast, as well as, I think you got a new edition of One coming out, or The One?
No, we just did an edition of Heartburst, a new printing of that.
Okay.
And I'm planning a hardcover edition of Brat Pack.
Brat Pack, one of the original deconstructions of the superhero myths that people seem to lately be jumping on to the, I don't know, the bus. I'm trying to think of the right term to say. But, it's something that's happening a lot nowadays. I guess it's that whole nostalgia thing where, I guess, you know, things resurface. So, Army at Love, tell us how that got started up.
Oh, God, I don't know. You know, you just, as an artist, you sort of like kind of fill the back of your brain with a lot of ideas and concepts and feelings and intuitions and stuff. And you kind of, you know, turn that into a novel, I guess. And, you know, that's kind of what Army at Love is. You know, the things that, you know, a year and a half, 2 years ago that I was really passionate about and, you know, putting a lot of thought into. You just sort of roll them up in a ball and, you know, make a great piece of work out of them.
It turns into a book.
Yeah.
Now, politically, these aren't new viewpoints for you, are they?
Well, yeah, I'm you know, a flaming liberal, I guess, you know. and, you know, I don't have a lot of, I don't know if the word is respect for what's going on, you know, in this country. So I tend to respond to that stuff when it gets out of hand with, you know, the wickedest satire that I can generate. It's, I guess it's my sort of, you know, relief valve or something for, you know, putting up with all that stuff. And so books like Brat Pack and Army at Love, I think both, you know, kind of fit in that sort of niche for me of, you know, just letting off that, you know, steam of helplessness, I guess, that you just can't affect how out of control things are kind of getting.
It just jumped into my mind is I wonder how much influence of your brother's strip he did with Greg Irons back in what, the late early 70s, late 60s, about the war criminal from Vietnam. What was his name?
Oh, that was the Legions of Charlies.
Yes.
Yeah.
Casey?
Well, of course, that was an influence. I mean, I'd been collaborating with my brother Tom since we were kids. So I think, you know, even before I read Legions of Charlies, I kind of, you know, had a feel for that kind of dark satire.
Yeah, this is Colin, by the way. Hi.
Hey,
oh, yeah, Colin Upton's with us today.
I just wanted to say I've always found your career pretty remarkable because, to me, your work is very much that in spirit of an underground cartoonist, and yet you've managed to be published for most of your career in the mainstream. I was just wondering how you managed to do that.
I think it was, you know, being in the sort of right place at the right time. You know, I studied at Kubert School in the mid to late 70s, and Kubert School was in New Jersey, which was right outside of Manhattan, where the comic industry was pretty much centered in those days. So it was real easy for me to kind of network with editors and publishers right at a time where, you know, mainstream comics were kind of coming apart at the seams. And it didn't happen immediately, but they were looking for new directions, and one of the places they were looking, I think, was the underground. You know, I tended to butt heads with people in the mainstream side of things a lot, too, because, you know, I kind of always want to push the envelope a little farther than anyone's ready for. But, you know, I guess I've been lucky, too. You know, like I say, right time, right place.
Well, you started, your early work started mostly in Epic magazine, which was created as a reaction to Heavy Metal magazine?
Yeah, correct. I can remember going to meetings with the guys at Marvel, and, you know, they loved the look and feel of Heavy Metal, but because of the dodgy translations, they seemed to feel that the stories weren't coherent. I didn't agree with them. I kind of liked the sort of oblique story structure that the French were using. So Epic was specifically designed, you know, just to make a bit more sense to an American reader. I don't think any of the artists, you know, could hold a candle to what Moebius and those guys were doing. So it's always going to be sort of like, you know, second place compared to what we know of as Heavy Metal.
As the classic Heavy Metal.
Yeah.
Not the Julie Strain covers of...
Sexy Robots every other month.
Yeah. There's still some great stuff in it, but it's definitely not...
I still buy it every month, just because they are gems to be found.
On the Epic note, one story which I think is fabulous, I was reading in the back, I think in the Shiny Beast, was the one of the Stan Lee one, and then Archie Goodwin's reply of one of your stories.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I was just talking about, where, you know, I turned in a script that was sort of oblique in how it was structured. And they responded by saying, gee, we like the idea, but, you know, give it a hero who's got this conflict and, you know, like we create stories already. So, you know, that's exactly what I was running up against. And you know, that particular story, I think, really suffered for having that inserted in it. But, hey, I was young. I needed a gig. It paid really well. Hopefully people understand.
I guess for them it was really unexplored territory.
I think it was misunderstood. I don't think they quite grasped how literate, you know, Moebius was with what he was doing. And I think especially with work like The Airtight Garage, which kind of like, you know, breaks apart the whole concept of novel structure in this really beautiful and exquisite way. Most Americans could look at that and, you know, drool over the artwork, but just not have a clue what Giraud was getting at. And, yeah. I was just like totally addicted to that stuff. I just loved it.
It is quite a commitment to sit down with a stack of his work, and because it's not... Like, at surface, it's beautiful, but then as far as the storytelling, it's quite, I find, complex in a lot of the stuff.
Yeah, but I think that's what we need.
The inkle. Oh, yeah. No, I agree. I love his stuff. I'd love to talk to him one day. I think that's going to be a challenge. Army at Love. We'll jump back into those pants. How long of a story did you originally have intended, and did it kind of blossom as things got more and more screwed up in Iraq?
The hope was to create an ongoing series that I could just extend as long as I wanted. I already had an ultimate ending in mind that I could, you know, bring to bear at any point. Sales of the book haven't been all that great, so right now what they're doing is they're allowing me to do 6-issue miniseries, seeing how each one does, especially when it's collected as a trade paperback.
Mm-hmm.
So Army at Love, as much as I love it, is a little iffy at this point, as I'm just coming up to the end of this miniseries titled Army at Love, The Art of War. But it was created, in my mind anyway, as kind of like a vehicle to kind of comment and play with anything I wanted to, rather than, you know, adhere to a strict genre kind of thing. You know, right from the get-go, it's kind of a mashup between war comics, love comics, and, you know, absurdist politics. So it's kind of unlike anything else on the stands, I think.
Concur with that. I kind of feel like some of the ideas put forward, it's only a matter of time before they're adopted.
It's kind of scary how some of them are actually coming into play. One of the key setups was that, you know, and I think this is in the first or second issue, was that, you know, Coca-Cola marketers, or Poca-Cola in my book it's called, marketers were, you know, actually rebranding the war, which everybody thought was absurd. But sure enough, you know, about 2 or 3 months ago, NATO announced that they had hired this Coca-Cola executive to rebrand their whole operation. And, you know, it's stuff like that you just couldn't make up, you know.
In Afghanistan.
You mean Afghanistan or Afghanistan?
Oh, I'm sure. No, the Coca-Cola guy, he's rebranding Afghanistan or Iraq as well.
Well, NATO is not involved in Iraq.
He's rebranding NATO.
Oh, wow.
How do you brand a military institution?
Well, because basically everything we kind of take in through all our media is a form of branding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people think they're hearing the news and stuff, but a lot of that is pushed through by marketing on a very subversive and large scale. Ideas are pushed by marketers. I think that's one of the key things about Army at Love. That's really what it's about. So I guess, you know, I would love it if I could sort of, like, hit people to that, make them more aware of that. Because, you know, when I talk to people, they're all talking about the same ideas that they got on the computer or on the television that day.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you work in any kind of public relations, or if you ever have, you know that that stuff is just, you know, ideas are being pushed through the media into people's minds.
Is there a place you go to for more reliable information?
You mean in terms of Army at Love?
Well, in terms of the situation in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, I'm a newspaper junkie. So. I read the Times and I read the Wall Street Journal every day, and plus a local newspaper as well. And it's pretty easy now online to get a lot of information. I can't vouch for how good it is because, again, information, I think, is being shaped on a major scale for political and commercial reasons. And I guess that's the point of my whole book.
I'm going to do a quick song break. It's about almost 20 past. I was going to play... I'm going to play the Mozart. How does that sound? Or no... Yeah, the Mozart.
On college radio?
Yeah. I picked through the stuff and found one that sounds actually quite enjoyable.
Rockin'.
So we'll be right back with Rick Veach and Ink Studs, CITR 101.9 FM. This is CITR 101.9 FM, Ink Studs. I was going to do my Jürgen Goth impression, and Colin said no one would get it, so I'm not going to bother. He's the host of CBC FM's Sunday afternoon classical, and he has the world's most monotone, send you to sleep voice. But that little piece wasn't sleepy time. That was actually quite energetic. We are joined by our special guest this week, Rick Veitch. And I keep wanting to slip into saying Veitch, because I had Kim Deitch in town a while ago, and it's spelled similar, but it's Veitch.
It's Veitch.
So I've got it right. Woo! Tell us about the Mozart pick.
Oh, yeah, the Mozart thing. That particular piece you played wasn't the piece I was talking about. I must have got the...
You just said the Ninth Symphony. You didn't give me a...
But when I was in high school, you know, I didn't know anything about classical music and probably never listened to it. But one day I was in Amherst, Massachusetts, sitting in a parking lot in a car. I might have been 17 years old, 18 years old. And I was just, you know, flipping the dial on the radio, just trying to find a station. And I, you know, inadvertently got a public radio station, and they were playing this bit of Mozart. I didn't know it at the time, but it caught my attention. And it was Christmas time, and you know, a lot of the streets were full of people all rushing around and doing all this stuff. And you know, for a few minutes I listened to the Mozart piece, and as I raised my eyes and looked at all the people in the street, suddenly they were coordinated with the music. You know, not as if they were dancing, but as if Mozart had caught some deeper meaning of chaos within the structure of his music. And I was like, right from there, I said, who is that guy? Well, you know, how did he do that? And you know, I began to get much more interested at that point, and you know, found out who Mozart was, and you know, listened to his other symphonies and his concertos and stuff like that. And I gotta say, he's got something. You know, the way he kind of like does these cascading ascending and descending mathematical repetitions just kind of like opens up my mind in a way that, you know, no other musical guy does.
There's only one Mozart, unfortunately. A man of to himself. I'm curious about Can't Get No. It kind of feels like a connected to Army of Love in some ways.
How so?
Just the theme of that kind of dystopian reaction to present day politics.
Yeah, I can see that.
What was the idea of doing the book? Because it's very unconventional.
Well, I, you know, having been working on comics, you know, for 20, 25 years at that point, you know, one of the tricks that we use in making a comic book, and Colin probably can talk about this as well, is how we juxtapose word and image.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, you know, since when you read a comic, you are absorbing word and image pretty much at the same time, I think it's that part of it that really gives you a buzz, because it kind of operates gets both sides of your brain, you know, operating at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, you know, pretty much even a junkie comic has a little something to it that kind of wakes you up. And so I wanted to play with that with Can't Get No. I was interested in, I've always been interested in poetry, and always been thinking about like how I could bring poetic sensibility to writing comics. And with Can't Get No, it was an experiment in how do you break that apart? How do you separate what's in the caption from the action in the picture? And can a reader bridge that gulf with what's in themselves?
How did 9/11 affect you?
It kind of was like being kicked in the stomach. I didn't expect that at all. And, you know, the carnage and everything was just, you know, ridiculous.
Now, are you referring to the carnage as part of the event and the follow-up to what happened?
Well, you know, the initial event itself, you know, mm-hmm. I'm, you know, just concentrating on that, the carnage involved there.
Mm-hmm.
The symbolism, I think, of hitting the Twin Towers wasn't lost on me. You know, I definitely wish politically the United States had been a little bit more intelligent about what came next, because it seemed to me that our guys just kind of played into Bin Laden's hands by, you know, going after this crazy war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And further destabilize the region.
Yeah, and our economy. You know, this whole, you know, crazy thing that we're going through right now, the economy, might very well be linked to the expenses of the war.
Oh, for sure. I mean, it's... there's no doubt about that, I think. I mean, it's just the massive amount of money that's spent each day, and, you know, I mean, kind of reminds me of how broke was the States after Vietnam.
And look at what happened to the Soviet Union after Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
They went kind of broke, you know, and lost in Afghanistan, and it wasn't too many years later that the whole Union came apart. So theoretically, if, you know, I don't know anything about Bin Laden or these guys or what they really want, or even if they're really real, I don't really know. they might. It seems possible that they could be strategizing with how to bankrupt the whole endeavor of the United States.
Mm-hmm. No, it's. I was interested. I missed the latest debate, but the second one, I found it quite interesting when McCain was talking about the. The efforts that the United States has made, especially with regards to Afghanistan, and saying that, you know, it was, you know, we've been involved there a long time. We supported the freedom fighters against the Russians back in the 80s, and now we're doing the same with the Taliban. And I was like, aren't they the same people?
Yeah, the other interesting thing is that, well, the Taliban controlled Afghanistan. They almost completely eradicated poppy production.
Yeah.
And ever since we've been back, it's like poppy production is higher than it's ever been.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's going on there?
So when 9/11 happened and the war happened, I'm just wondering, do you think you could have done something like Army at Love a few years ago? Did there have to be some time?
I think, you know, that the book really got going right at that point when we were in Iraq, where everything seemed to be going wrong. You know, the military kind of like pulled back into these kind of places, you know, kind of like safer zones, and they weren't really trying to police what was going on in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
And so there'd be like 40 bombings a day, you know, and just this incredibly horrible carnage and people being murdered all over the place. And it was at that point that I was just going, this is so out of hand. You know, since then, they have this thing that they call the surge, but I think what that was they actually took responsibility for policing
themselves?
Big areas of Iraq that they hadn't been doing, and that's really where the success comes from, is, you know, they're getting around to doing what they should have been done a long time ago.
But
do you think you could have actually, the publishers would have been brave enough, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago to publish something like Army at Love?
Well, you know, Vertigo, I think, is, you know, is open to those kind of ideas, or these kind of ideas. You know, whether or not exactly if Army at Love would have worked a few years earlier, I don't know. I mean, probably not if I, you know, pitched it right at the time where everyone was all patriotic and we were just going into Iraq and mowing down the Iraqi army. That probably wouldn't have been a good time. But, you know, maybe by waiting those 2 or 3 years until things got really crazy, you know, that really helped sell it anyway. Hard to say with those things.
Now, one thing that's changed with your artwork with Can't Get No and Army Love is you no longer focus on the use of the airbrushing. How, I'm trying to think of the right term. It seems a lot less laborious for you. Has that been able to, like, let go and get more into what you're doing?
Yeah, I find that when I just pencil for someone else to ink, then I pencil a lot tighter, and I spend more time at it, because if I'm inking my pencils, there's a lot of stuff I won't really work out in hopes that I'll get it in the inking. but penciling, you know, you just, if you want something to look right, you got to get it right there so that the inker can see the line so that he can ink them.
So they don't ink your mistakes.
Yeah. Well, that happens. But I would have to say that, you know, I've been concentrating more and more on the penciling. When I was doing Can't Get No, I mean, a lot of those were inked over very rough simple pencils.
But I'm just wondering about the fact that, like, previous a lot of your work, I shouldn't say that because your dream stuff wasn't airbrushed. I'm just thinking of a lot of your 80s stuff was focused on the airbrushing and the really complex
layers. Well, you know what? That's all kind of gone away, too, and it's moved onto the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And I've taught myself, you know, Photoshop, and am now coloring all my covers or anything that I do color, I do, you know, in Photoshop. I get just the same effects, but without all the toxic stuff in my lungs. I did a story with that Alan Moore wrote for Tomorrow Stories that was like a retro comic. And, you know, we did it, you know, all new material, all black and white material, and then I scanned that in, and I scanned in old comic books, and I sampled the pulp and the big dots. And the thing came out. It looked so authentic that you can't believe it. So I'm really, you know, kind of getting more and more into this Photoshop thing. There's basically anything you can imagine now you can do, which is kind of cool.
Well, I've heard that from many a source.
Yeah.
How, working with Alan Moore, did that develop your own sense of writing?
Well, he was always, like, so far ahead of me. I had read the Marvel Man stuff before. It was called Miracle Man. It was Marvel Man that was coming in Warrior, and I was stunned by what he had pulled off in those first three or four chapters. And it was right at that time that my friend Steve Bissett was partnered up with Alan for Swamp Thing. And so since I lived right near Steve, I got to see those first scripts for the anatomy lesson and those early Swamp Things.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just so obvious that Alan was making everything else in comics obsolete, just, you know, by the sheer power of his intellect and the ability to communicate what he wanted to the artist and inspire the artist in the script. That was so key to what he was doing. So, knowing Alan, working with Alan, seeing his material on that side of it, kind of raised the bar for me as well as it did for everybody else. There's a great video of Paul Levitz discussing Alan Moore and how when he had a group of, you know, poker players where they, you know, would meet it once a week to play poker and stuff, and he tells how when Watchmen came out, every single one of them just tore up whatever they were doing. And said, you know, we got to start over again. And that was the impact of Alan. I was so close to it. You know, I have a different perspective on it, I think, than a lot of other people. But he's a major cultural guy. And, it's not over yet. I think the culture will raise him up and see him as something really important.
Now he's been on The Simpsons.
Yeah. But I think, you know, it'll be key to watch how this Watchmen movie, you know, is marketed and whether or not it's a success and all that kind of stuff. I think it's really great that he essentially turns his back on it, gives away all the money. I mean, how great is that? You know?
Well, if it's anything like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, I'm not raising my hopes too high.
Oh, no, all the movies of his stuff have been terrible.
Yeah.
But at the same time, they become these kind of like cultural artifacts that people plug into. I mean, most people will know Alan Moore through the Watchmen movie, unfortunately.
I find it interesting as a, and I don't want to dwell too much on Alan because you've got so much work to talk about, just my own little commentary on the choice of the time to bring out the Watchmen, because the director did it, the same guy who did the very neoconservative 300. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the fact that Watchmen is really, it's a testament of Cold War era politics to me. Mm. And to bring it out now, will it translate the same to people? And
that's its real heart, though. The heart of Watchmen is the evolution of the superhero. And, you know, superheroes, dark noir superheroes are hot shit right now in Hollywood, and they're making everybody a bazillion dollars. But just like, you know, cowboys were once on top of the heap, cowboys had to evolve.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, I think you're going to play a piece from Sergio Leone movie, right?
Sure, I can play that once we're done talking on our
Well, the superhero genre in film has to evolve the same way from simple vigilante black versus white to more complex depths. And I think Watchmen is going to be that big step. It's not about, you know, heroism in any simple sense. It's really about what trying to be a hero does to a real human being. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the key to the success of all of Allen's work.
Humanism.
Yeah, making those genre characters human beings. There's a bit in The Miracle Man he did with John Tottleman. I don't know if you remember all this stuff.
I read half of The Miracle Man's, I think.
I have them.
But it all builds to this point where Miracle Man's secret identity, Mike Moran, realizes that to save the world, he's got to say the magic word, and he's never going to come back, and that no one else is even going to know he did this. And he kind of like, he only has a few minutes before the world's going to be destroyed, so he's got to do this. But he takes this little pile of stones and makes this little cairn to himself, you know, in hopes that somebody somewhere will remember who Mike Moran was. And then he says the magic word and turns into Miracle Man and goes and saves the world.
And now for some Ennio Morricone. We'll be right back. Thanks, Dad. CITR 101.9. I really feel like I need to go on a quest now.
I love that stuff.
Colin, treasure hunt?
What does that mean?
Treasure hunt. Let's go on a treasure hunt.
Oh, okay. Now?
Right now.
Oh, man.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is Ink Studs. We're talking to Rick Veach. Colin and I were just talking during our little musical break, and one thing noticeable about your stuff is, I guess, altered consciousness?
Yeah.
How did psychedelics figure in your creative process as a young man?
Not as much as you might think. I mean, you know, I did grow up in the 60s, so I tried all that stuff. But I kind of grew up in an odd town where it was just full of, you know, people getting drunk and getting high all the time. And so early on, I sort of looked at it and went, wait, you know, what I'm seeing here with what most people are doing isn't really about raising consciousness. It's just really about, you know, getting smashed. So I actually kind of like got out of all that stuff at an early age. You know, I don't think I did anything, you know, stronger than smoke a joint, you know, since I was 19.
Well, that just smashes my...
the thing is, once it happens, you know, you're over there. You never come back.
The doors of perception have been opened.
Yeah.
So what is the interest in that whole altered consciousness, dreams? Where does that stem from for you?
Well, you know, I've always been interested in dreaming from the time I was a kid. But I think as an adult, my interest is in all forms of consciousness. I think consciousness is the big mystery when it comes to understanding what it means to be alive. You know, scientists tend to tell us that, you know, it's just a trick of the brain, that we only think that we're conscious and crap like that. But anybody who has experienced psychedelics or gotten into their dreams tends to think that consciousness is actually dimensional or something, or there's more to it. So I've always tried to explore that in at least parts of my work. And I think comics, because of the way they work on the brain, they give you that little buzz, that little frisson, are a perfect medium to kind of, you know, create actual sensations in the mind of your reader.
Well, actually, comics are perfect for that translating that dream experience, because, like, I've read people's dream journals, and they just kind of, they don't construct it as well with a comic, where you can bring together that visual that may not be describable with words.
And since a dream is made up of many layers of symbolism, then a comic is the perfect medium to carry that, because you're drawing all this stuff. And when we look at a drawing, it kind of activates the symbol making and symbol understanding part of our minds.
Now, what was it like getting other folks to pass along their own dream comics?
It was great, because what would happen would be, after they would do it, they would like turn to me and they would just go, "Veach, this is incredible. You know, I got so much out of this." And this is from like old guys who've been doing comics for 100 years and were sick of it, and, you know, sick of the grind and everything. But you know, when you're drawing your own dream, you kind of activate your intuition, your artistic and creative intuition, in this really kind of cool way. And so as you're putting the dream to paper in images, this intuition is sort of like reaching all around, trying to get a handle on the meaning of the dream. It's sort of trying things on. Well, what if this symbolizes this, and this symbolizes that, and this symbolizes this? And by the time you're done, you've got a better grasp on the nature of the dream and what it was trying to tell you, what it might be a piece of, than if you had just had it and written it down.
Was part of the reason for doing that extended run as a way of just kind of stepping back within your own storytelling to try moving yourself in a direction you hadn't tried before?
No, it was to self-exploration. You know, I was using comics, which is a commercial medium, as if I were a painter, to just explore the depths of myself. You know, it's pretty obvious to me for years before I did River Fiends that dreams could make great comics. Mm-hmm. But what happened was I got caught up in that early 24-hour comic challenge that the class put out.
It's happening again this Saturday.
Oh, good. Yeah. And so anyway, I was one of the first ones, although he disqualified me because I didn't do it just right.
Oh, Scott.
But in the process, I got about a month's worth of dreams down, and I began to see the patterns that were there, which I had missed before. And so I thought, shit, if I can figure out a way to do this, to, you know, spend a couple of years doing this, there's no limit to what I might be able to discover about myself. And right at that time, I had some good fortune where I did an image comic, and made enough money to self-publish the comic for a couple of years.
Do you have any trouble remembering your dreams?
No.
Oh.
I've got this little notebook next to the bed, and the first thing I try to think of in the morning is, what was that dream about? And I try to move it from the dreaming part of my mind into where the memory cells are. And from there, I'll write it down, and then in the evening, I'll read it again, and more of it will surface.
Are you still keeping a dream diary?
Oh, yeah, sure.
What are some insights you've gotten from your dreams?
Insights? Well, you mean personal or like on a collective sense?
Either. That'll get hard for you.
Okay, well, personal. If you read my book, Crypto Zoo, I did that book in my 40s, but it was based on a series of dream journals I created when I was 20 years old. And it was, I started the dream series at a time when I was sort of falling apart. My life had come apart. I was all screwed up in a lot of ways. And the dreams, just the act of writing all that stuff down and paying attention to my dreams, pulled me out of all that and set me on the path to a more whole personality. At the same time, you read that book and you can see it's clearly pointing me in the direction of becoming a professional cartoonist. And it was doing that in the face of the fact that in my heart of hearts, I was terrified that I was never going to be able to do this because it was something that I knew I had to do. And that particular series of dreams, as documented in CryptoZoo, is my unconscious showing me that it can be done. There are points in there where the future is kind of shown to me, like what my life is going to be like. And it helped inspire me and set me on the right path.
What kind of stuff do we have to look forward to coming from you in the future?
Well, I'm just finishing up Army at Love, The Art of War. So there'll be 6 issues of that.
That's at issue 2 or 3 right now.
Yeah, I think number 3 just came out. I'm not sure if there'll be another one after that. A lot will depend on how sales are for the trade paperbacks.
And hear that, people? Buy them.
Yeah.
I was just curious if you'd heard any feedback from the people, the troops, people who've been in Iraq or anything like that?
Yeah. The Armed Forces newspaper actually did a story about Army of Love.
Stars and Stripes?
Emails from people in Iraq who wanted to read the comic, but... you know, they just can't get it over there. And I tried to line up comic book dealers who could send it, you know, they could buy it from, but I wasn't able to do it.
Well, in the green zone.
I also did an interview with a guy from a German newspaper who had been there. And he said, you know, I can't believe that you caught the tone of the troops. You know, you're right on the money with how they feel over there. And I would have nothing to base that on. You know, it just came out of me. I don't know why I got that, but
your conscious imagination.
Maybe, or maybe those dreams are coming. I don't know.
There we go. That's another. Now the covers of the latest Army of Love series are all based on old paintings.
Yeah.
What was the choice with the? Is it kind of a reimagining of the past with a violent overtone?
Yeah, or how something as treasured as like ancient art can be turned into propaganda. You know, I'm trying to make that point.
Oh. I think we're nearing the end of our time slot. Got a couple more minutes. One quick question. I guess my brain's totally...
I have a question. I have a question.
Go ahead, Colin.
Do you ever stay awake at night worried that maybe some marketing consultant is reading Army at Love and picking up ideas?
Yeah, I have thought about that, or that people, your readers might read it and think, oh boy, it'll be fun to be in the war. You know, I would feel bad if somebody joined the Army because they read Army at Love and thought they could get laid under combat, you know?
Sometimes satire, people have trouble recognizing satire when they see it.
Yeah, well.
One thing that was interesting for me about reading Army of Love is after I read that, I watched that HBO miniseries, Generation Kill. I don't know if you saw that.
I didn't see the miniseries, but I read the book.
And it has that same idea that, like, I don't know, the lost innocence in the army. Is that what I'm going at?
Yeah, I mean, the book, like I said, I haven't seen the TV series, but the book was, you know, it just floored me. It was written by some guy who was part of one of those spearheads, you know, a motorized spearhead that just went into Iraq. And, you know, these guys would go cruising through a town and just shoot the whole place up.
Mm-hmm. It's quite terrible.
Yeah, it's, you know...
Tragic?
In America, we tend to... Right now, we tend to, like, talk about what the war means to Americans, but we ought to spend some time thinking about all those Iraqis. You know, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed over there, and it's just, you know.
Oh, it just seems like the further the war goes along, the more like Vietnam it's sounding.
Well, you know, I was around during Vietnam, and the difference is that there was the draft during Vietnam. So it was a very personal issue with everybody, and it was real easy to say no to the war because you didn't want to be part of the war. Where this one is kind of, you know, the way they operate, it's like everybody is disconnected from the war.
And so much of the fighting in Iraq is, in fact, being done by private companies and mercenary outfits.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if we'll ever know what really goes on over there. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, maybe 10 years from now, somebody will dig it up, but... You know, there are hardly any reporters reporting out there in the real war. I think the only one I found was the guy from the Times there, Dexter Filkins, who just wrote a great book. But he was out there in the middle of it, in the worst of it, you know, not doing this embedded thing, but actually reporting on what was really going on. We needed a lot more of that.
Joe Sacco has done some tours of Iraq doing stories.
Yeah, right. He's great.
Yeah. The Complacency Kills.
Mm-hmm.
That was the Sacco strip. Fantastic piece.
Yes.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Rick.
Well, thanks for having me, Rob.
And I look forward to more issues of Army at Love. I do think it's fabulous, and I hope other people do as well.
I'm just amazed it's being published at all.
I am too, Colin.
That's one thing, you know, it surprises me, is a publisher in the past that's had problems with controversial material... And you're able to go back and publish something that is really against the grain of popular
sentiment.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I'd have to say, though, that considering what happened with all those drawings of Muhammad and the political repercussions of that, maybe DC Comics was right not to let me put Jesus in there.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. Hey. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Rick, and have a swell evening.
Thank you.
All right. Good night, guys.
Okay, bye. And, folks, just a reminder, we got some stuff happening on that was Rick Veach, Army at Love is his latest book, as well as Can't Get No, and self-published a lot of stuff through his publishing house, King Hell Press, including Brat Pack, Max Immortal, The One, Abraxas and the Earthmen, Rabbit Eye, Pocket Universe, Crypto Zoo, I didn't say cryptic, but crypto. Did I say Shiny Beast? And from Vertigo, Can't Get No, and books 1 and 2 of Army at Love, as well as 4 issues left in the most recent miniseries, The Art of War.
He's a prolific guy.
He is. And he also has, from DC, the whole bunch of Swamp Things up until he didn't do it anymore. And also there is... I can't even think. The stuff he did with Elmore, Tomorrow's Stories, and the... Why can't I think of the name of the main character he did? But he did a miniseries by himself, written and drawn. And I just don't stop talking. He did the Supreme with Elmore, all the wonderful classic Silver Age style strips. On Sunday night, if you're in Vancouver... At RX Comics after 6 o'clock, my good friend Miriam Libicki will be doing a launch party for the latest book, or her, not latest, but the collection of Jobnik. This is her actually putting into a beautiful graphic novel format. She's been working on this for years, and she's redrawn a lot of stuff, relettered it, and it looks fantastic.
Character for Tomorrow Comics was Gray Shirt.
Yes, the Gray Shirt miniseries. which was a good take on some classic pulp,
mm-hmm.
a la The Spirit. Very much influenced by The Spirit.
Yes.
Up next, Crimes and Treasons. I'm going to end off with some Miles Davis. Let's see if these boys will stay cool.